The Mises Institute is making Dr. Ron Paul's monograph, Gold, Peace, and Prosperity, available for free to our podcast listeners. This quick read covers the history of monetary destruction and makes a case for sound money. Get your free copy at Mises.org/HAPodFree. This is the Human Action Podcast, where we debunk the economic, political, and even cultural myths of the days. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Murphy.
Jonathan, welcome back to the Human Action Podcast.
Hi, Bob. It's good to be back.
Well, even though it's good to have you back here, the topic, the reason I wanted you to come is I can't go through this alone anymore. And specifically, I'm referring to the MMT stuff that, once again, the MMT champions are running victory laps on Twitter when, to my mind, you know, it's not that they're supposed to hold up the white flag and have unconditional surrender, but I don't think the data have been kind to their perspectives in the last few years, and yet they're running around saying, yeah, we nailed it. So specifically, folks, what happened, the reason I'm bringing Jonathan on here, what we're going to discuss is about a week ago, there was a Martin Wolf piece in, what was it, the FT, I think, that was making the rounds. This called The Tree of Debt Must Stop Growing. So we'll link to it, of course, here, folks, at the show notes page. And I don't need to go through it, but it was a very, I thought, good piece, just summarizing a lot of the data. So for listeners of this podcast and people just go to Mises.org in general, it's a lot of familiar territory, but really just showing, I think, how things really are, the walls are closing in, as they say, right, in terms of the various advanced economies and how much debt they've been issuing and how this isn't going to continue and this is going to end badly, and why don't we start trying to get ahead of this, because the longer we delay, the worse it's going to be. And so what was happening on Twitter a week ago or whatever is that was making the rounds, and then fans of MMT were kind of showing the counterpoint and saying, no, back in the day, it turns out, from 2020, this is really what the truth was. And this was a different perspective that, you know, is more poignant today than it was even back then. And it was excerpts from Stephanie Kelton, and she had like a debate that was hosted on the FT, you know, platform. I think it was just written. I don't think they were doing it live against each other in real time, where she said several things, including the claim that, let's see, this was the screenshot that caught my eye. So I'll let Jonathan jump in here, and then we'll sort of go through this more methodically, folks. But the claim from Stephanie Kelton that allegedly blew up the latest hand-wringing over the debt from Martin Wolf was this. So today, governments sell bonds to protect something more valuable than gold, a well-guarded secret about the true nature of their fiscal capacities, which, if widely understood, might lead to calls for overt monetary financing to pay for public goods. By selling bonds, they maintain the illusion of being financially constrained. Okay, and so that was the claim that just jumped out at me, and I retweeted that and said, well, I know what we're doing the podcast on next week. And so I'll stop there at that point. And Jonathan, before we sort of just start going through, so what I suggest we do, Jonathan, is not so much focus on Martin Wolf's latest piece, because again, he's kind of just documenting how bad the fiscal position is of the major sovereign governments around the world, particularly the U.S., but people pointing back at this debate between Stephanie Kelton and a budget hawk at the time, back in 2020, right when the, you know, pandemic first crisis set in, and saying how she just nailed it. So I think we're going to go look and see what her arguments were at the time, and then also now with the benefit of 4 years to see how did her guidance play out in their interim. So I'll pause there, Jonathan, and perhaps you want to add a word or two to this episode.
Sure. Yeah. So one common theme that I see in MMT, and it's on display here, is that they oftentimes they'll make these like very big claims, usually based on like some twisting some of the words around, and then when you try to press them on it, they back into some different claim that's more defensible about like just the mechanisms by which debt is sold and bought and debt is monetized. And so like one thing here is that they're saying that the debt is sort of like this vestige of the gold standard, and it gives the appearance that governments are budget constrained today, even though today we have fiat currencies. And so, like, and if the government is able to just spend money into existence now that they issue this fiat currency, then there's no reason why the government needs to sell bonds. That's the claim that they're making. And so it's another example of them like making this sort of like controversial claim that gets people to bite. It's almost like this bait. And then once you go into it, then they sort of step back. And so the way that they step back here is they say, oh, there's all these ways that the government can control interest rates. There's all these ways that governments can deal with the price inflation problems that would come up as a result, and that would involve taxes and all of these other sorts of schemes, yield curve control. And so it's just another example I see of that sort of theme in MMT talk.
Yeah, that's my overall take too. And so I'll recycle an analogy that I used back when I debated Warren Mosler. And you'll never believe it, folks. I hope you're sitting down. So I debated Warren Mosler. It was hosted at Columbia. This was a while ago at this point. And you should just see how youthful and innocent I look in the video. I hadn't yet seen what politicians were capable of. But back then, and you'll never guess, in the comments, the MMT people think that Warren crushed me, and the Austrians think that I made really good points. So I know, I hope everyone was sitting down for that. But in any event, the analogy I used was I said, you know, imagine that there's a husband and wife and they're sitting down and they're worried about the budget. And the wife is saying, you know, geez, I think we got to stop going out to eat so much because I'm just looking at these numbers here, honey. And with our income and our spending right now, it just doesn't work. Yeah, we've run up some credit card debts or whatever, but I mean, the chickens are going to come home to roost. And the husband says, whoa, why do you keep acting like our income from our jobs has to be higher than how much we spend each month? That's not the case. So it's like, stop, you know, get out of that household budget mentality. That's you know, an old way of thinking, because I can just put on a ski mask and go down to the local 7-Eleven and hold them up at gunpoint, right? And so I don't need to go earn more money, or we don't need to tighten our belts. I just have to go hold up 7-Elevens and liquor stores, and we can get everything we want that way. And then the wife starts to look surprised, and the husband says, oh, no, I know what you're thinking. I'm not saying there are no consequences for me doing that. My point is merely, let's stop thinking of it like, how are we going to balance the budget? And instead think of it as, what's the trade-off between what we want to buy and the chance of me going to prison for life? That's really what the trade-off is. Let's stop thinking about, like, we got to balance the budget, because that's a... And so my point would be, is the husband wrong? Well, no, not literally. What he's saying is technically correct. Did he just introduce a new way of thinking about the family finances? And it's an improvement upon the way the wife was looking? No, absolutely not. Okay. And so I think that's the thing is, that analogy gives too much credit to the MMT people. Because again, as Jonathan was alluding to there, they will always congratulate themselves and say, oh, we always admit that inflation could be a problem. And if the government just spends too much money on things and, you know, there's not enough real resources to back up that inflation could be a problem. But that's something like when I used to read Murray Rothbard, you know, when I was like in high school reading Man Economy, or maybe it was undergrad. I don't remember what I said, got into Man Economy and State per se. But I mean, it was standard. He would say, yeah, there's three ways the government can pay for things, either taxing, borrowing, or inflation. Okay, so this isn't some newfound revelation that, oh, wow, the way government can take control of resources is by running the printing press. Who would have thought? This is obvious stuff. And then, you know, if you ask Rob, well, what's the downside of that? He'd say, oh, because prices would rise, and that would just be an implicit tax, a transfer of resources from the currency holders to, you know, the government. And so that's taxation via a different mechanism. So I'm just saying the basic framework, both sides agree with. MMT is not contributing anything novel by pointing that out. And then where the disagreement lies is, well, how bad is the trade-off? How much leeway does the government have to do these things? And that's where we disagree. And I don't think that they're right. In other words, it's not merely from armchair reasoning that you can make that determination. So where the MMT camp, again, in other words, any insight they give you, any answers that pop out from their approach that the old fuddy-duddies who think governments kind of need to, you know, raise funds to pay for things, any new answer that pops out would be wrong. Just like with the husband and the wife example, that, you know, him pointing out, oh, wait a minute, there's this other margin of discretion that we have that's not really, you know, helping anything. And if anything, it's going to mislead you.
Yeah, the difference between the MMT, or one of the differences between the MMTers and the Austrians and other anti-MMT folks, is that the MMTers are the ones that are cheerleading the guy for coming up with this idea that he could go rob the 7-Eleven. It's like this brilliant insight. It's like, oh yeah, that's, he's finally got it. He's figured out how he can, you know, get his household out of this financial problem. And then everybody else is like, well, I think there's some issues there. I think there's some there's going to be some negative consequences if you do that sort of thing. It reminds me of a similar sort of exercise that I did using Kelton had tweeted like this step-by-step process by which the government spends money into the economy and provides all these like net, she calls them net financial assets for the private economy. And I just went through and replaced each line of her step where she mentions the government with the counterfeiter just to show that as soon as you realize that the government is creating new units of currency and what the effects of that monetary inflation is, then it sort of brings to light that there's all these well-known consequences to monetary inflation that have been around economics literature for hundreds of years. And yet they're sort of trying to sneak their way through the words to come to this supposedly new insight that the government can, you know, debase the currency and acquire resources that way. And also, of course, they're all talking about full employment, and whenever they're offering their policy prescriptions, it's always this assumption that there's all these idle resources in the economy. So in that sense, it's like a hyper Keynesianism, because they assume that the government would be able to bring those so-called idle resources into employment if only the government could just command the resources using inflation, debt, whatever it takes.
Yeah, exactly. So why don't we? I have points to make on that narrow topic you just raised there, Jonathan, about the MMT view that government budget deficits create net financial assets for the private sector. But why don't we, just in fairness to Kelton, quote a little bit from her piece, because that's the third point she raises.
I don't think it's very fair to Kelton to just quote her.
Yeah. So why don't we go ahead and do so again, and we'll link, obviously, if people want to go look at this in the original. So this is coming from the FT, the title, this was back in May 3rd, 2020. So everyone just remember your timeline. COVID-19 stuff really started kicking in, at least in the US, in March of 2020. And then, you know, the lockdowns kicked in, I think, in April. And so here we are at this point is when this debate occurs about 2 months into the governments around the world doing lockdowns and central banks open up the monetary spigots and central governments racking up enormous amounts of debt. So the title of this exchange was, "Can governments afford the debts they're piling up to stabilize economies?" And since it's British, they spell stabilize with an S at the end, not a Z. Two experts debate the long-term impact on inflation of the COVID-19 rescue packages. And so it's between Stephanie Kelton and Edward Chancellor. And what's funny, like this chance, I think that name is just a coincidence. I don't think he actually, you know, was a chancellor. So here's Kelton answering, and we'll focus on her. So again, the question, the debate the topic to be resolved was, can governments afford the debts they're piling up to stabilize economies? So Kelton says, yes, it poses no inherent danger to states that issue their own currency. So I'll just go through here. She, you know, kind of summarizes, you know, some people think that this is important, that the governments are spending all this money in light of the pandemic and to compensate businesses and workers who are being forced to stay home. Others are worried that it's going to lead to rising interest rates and And she's saying they should not be worried. While public debt can create problems in certain circumstances, it poses no inherent danger to currency issuing governments such as the US, Japan, or the UK. And it's not because these countries can currently borrow at very low cost. Rather, there are three real reasons as to why it's okay that governments like the US, Japan, and the UK don't need to worry about issuing debt to pay for, you know, pandemic era spending. First, a currency issuing government never needs to borrow in its own currency. And what she means there is just they can just print the money, right? It's not that the US is ever going to run out of dollars. The Japanese is never gonna, they're never going to run out of yen. The UK out of pounds. They can just create more at will. So they don't need to borrow. They're just doing that for some other reason. Second, it can always determine the interest rate on bonds it chooses to sell. And third, government bonds help to shore up the private sector's finances. All right, so those are the three main things, and she unpacks them a little bit. So for our purposes here, Jonathan, why don't we just elaborate on what you said there for point number three. Again, where she's coming from is she's saying the typical way people think about government debt is exactly backwards. Far from all this outstanding government debt, like in the U.S., you know, treasury debt being a drag on the finance, on the private sector, because, oh, gee, now the citizens have to pay more taxes to service the debt. You know, gee, look at the CBO came out and interest costs are consuming a bigger fraction of the federal budget. And pretty soon, actually, it's the case right now, folks, in case you don't know. Right now, this fiscal year, the U.S. government is spending more on interest payments on the existing federal debt than on the military. And it's not because the military budget is so small. It's because they're both enormous. And so where she's coming from is to say, oh, don't look at it as a debt. It's an asset, right? Like mutual funds or whatever, retirement account. Like if they hold treasuries because they're a very safe asset, then, you know, that's an asset, right? And so my take on that, and Jonathan, I don't know if you want to elaborate from your point of view as well, is, yeah, from any individual entity's perspective, like a household or a company, if they have an IOU issued by the federal government that says the bearer of this 1 year from now will get $1,000. I understand in terms of the accounting that that's an asset, but as far as the country as a whole, no, that's nonsensical, right? And my analogy here that I've used before, I'll use again because I think it's a good one. If somebody borrows $1,000 from me and says a year from now, I'll give you $1,100 back, you know, for a 10% interest rate. Okay. That's fine. So I can view that IOU as an asset. But what if what happens is 12 months passes, the guy comes up to me and he says, okay, I owe you $1,100, right? And I say, yep. And he sticks a gun in my belly and says, give me $1,100 in cash. And I do. Just so happens I happen to have $1,100 in cash on me. He takes the $1,100 from me at gunpoint and then says, oh, you know that $1,100 I owe? Here you go. So if we knew going into it that that's what was going to happen, would we in any way think that that was a net asset that I held, that IOU entitling me to $1,100 in 12 months' time? No, we wouldn't. And yet that's the position that the country as a whole is in, to say, oh, wow, the U.S. government owes us in the aggregate $30 trillion, and so that we should view that as an asset. No, there's a fundamental difference between that and, say, holding a bunch of bonds issued by Fortune 500 companies, because they're, you know, if a pension fund owns a bunch of bonds issued by safe blue chip, you know, stock companies, how are they going to come up with them? They're going to sell goods and services to their customers. And that's the way they're going to. So that makes sense that in the aggregate, yes, those can legitimately be viewed as net financial assets to the holders. Whereas to throw in an entity in the mix that just gets it through coercion. And by the way, I'm not merely, it's not like I'm saying, oh, I don't like cigarettes, and so therefore bonds issued by the tobacco companies don't count as assets. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not just saying I don't like the government. That's what the MMT people sometimes give. I'm saying, no, there is a fundamental economic difference, regardless of your views on morality and natural law and whatever, between an entity that comes up with the money to pay you back, either by running the printing press or by just through coercion seizing the resources that way. It's not, there could be individual winners and losers, sure, but in the aggregate, no, everybody is made poorer by that system. And certainly we should not look at the outstanding stock of treasury debt as net assets held by the private sector. Any thoughts on that, Jonathan?
Yeah, you're talking about the same sorts of things that I brought up in an article that I wrote. I think it was called Bastiat versus MMT. And the whole idea was basically just to remind people, and this is what Bastiat did in his writings, is the government creates nothing. So whenever the government is doing something, it's going to involve some sort of transfer from one person to the others. The government can never just be a free gifter, like this sort of like generous outflower of real goods and services to the population. And so, like what you said, in the case where the government is paying debts, that money has got to come from somewhere. And if it comes from taxes, then it's very obvious that's just an expropriation from private citizens. If it comes through printing money to pay down the debts, then people are still going to feel that. Now there's going to be all the Cantillon effects where there's going to be winners and losers. But the point is that there are losers. People are going to have to pay higher grocery prices and pay higher prices for all sorts of things. And that is where we actually see and feel the expropriation. And, you know, coincidentally, that's why I think inflation is so attractive to governments, is because it's subtle and it's concealed and delayed. The effects are as opposed to something as obvious as taxes. So I think you're exactly right. It's a great analogy.
What about, so there, folks, we kind of hit the third of Kelton's three reasons why she thought as of May 2020 that no, the government's running up these massive debts to stabilize economies in light of the COVID panic. No big deal. The second one, so with a lot of these, John, I think our rhetorical response is kind of like, yeah, there's a weird way in which what they're saying is correct, but really in practice, you know, that was that sort of move we're making. But this second one, and she didn't really elaborate it, at least I didn't see in the piece, so I don't want to misrepresent her, but to me, this looks like prima facie, it's wrong. She says, second, a government like the kind she has in mind, the US, UK, or Japan, can always determine the interest rate on bonds it chooses to sell. How did you feel about that claim?
Well, she did explain it some when she was talking about the example of Japan. She said, as Japan has demonstrated with yield curve control, the interest rate on government bonds is a policy choice.
Oh, okay, thanks. Yeah. So See, folks, we're trying to be fair here. So yeah, what does she mean, Jonathan? And then how do you feel about that?
Well, so I'm not an expert on Japan, but the way I think I've the way I understand it is that the Japanese government has been able to basically fix long-term interest rates, and the way that they're able to do it is the Japanese households don't hold a lot of equity; they sort of indirectly hold government debt through their bank deposits in Japanese banks, and because of that, the Bank of Japan has been able to try to peg a certain long-term interest rate as opposed to what like the Fed usually does, which is like trying to influence short-term interest rates. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what she's talking about. Now, I'm not sure Japan is a very good example because they've had all sorts of issues with their debt and the amount of government spending and also the population issues. But she seems to think that it's a good example.
Okay. So thank you for reminding. I actually did remember that once you pointed it out, and I had forgotten when I was just skimming this again to see, wait a minute, where does she justify what she just said there in point number two? So right. The claim that the interest rate on government debt is a policy choice. She actually, I don't know if this was on your radar, Jonathan, but Stephanie Kelton was in a debate with Paul Krugman. Again, and when I say this, I don't mean like they were on a panel in front of a live audience. I mean, I think they were exchanging volleys in print, and Krugman accused them of playing Calvin ball. And I know, Jonathan, you're more of a Calvin and Hobbes fan than I am. So what can you explain to listeners? What did Krugman mean by referring to Calvin ball?
I've read some Calvin and Hobbes. If I remember correctly, it's this game where the rules are always changing, the goals are always changing, and it's just like this. It's basically just chaos where Calvin is, you know, contriving all these new ways of playing the game, and the game itself is shifting.
But yes, exactly. So the point being that, you know, more colloquially, people say, "Oh, she's moving the goalposts," right? So she would make a claim. So like I had to say, the government can determine the interest rate on bonds it sells. Well, I mean, no more so than in a, you know, in a direct literal sense than any corporate. You know, I can say, hey, I'm going to issue bonds from the Bank of Bob or the household of Bob, and I'm only going to pay 1% interest. But because of my credit rating and you know, maybe I'm not going to get many buyers at that. And it's the same thing when the Treasury goes in the market and issues new debt. It can't just force people to lend money on whatever terms it wants. There's a demand curve. Mm-hmm. For the government debt. And I know, Jonathan, maybe you want to chime in on this too. So there's that sense. Now, yes, because of the central bank sitting in the wings, it can come in and it can buy. And so, but then this was something that came up with QE, there was I forget what the term they used was, but there was a time, remember, Jonathan, right when, you know, Obama was in office and Bernanke was in charge of the Fed, and they came in with their QE programs, and partly what they wanted to do, one of the goals of QE was they wanted to reduce long-term interest rates as well. That they didn't want, you know, they had already pushed short-term interest rates down to zero, and that didn't seem to fix the economy. So maybe we got to push down long-term rates too. And so they changed. It wasn't just how many bonds are we buying, or, you know, bills, but they also like went out on the yield curve and they were buying, you know, more heavily in longer term things to try to push down the long-term rates as well. So yes, there's margins that you can do that sort of thing. Just like a private corporation could issue bonds of varying maturities to try to influence the shape of the yield curve, if you want to talk like that, for its own bond structure. But there's limits. And that's what Krugman was arguing with her, like saying, yeah, if you hold a bunch of other things constant, the Fed's got some wiggle room and it can do whatever. But it's not like in 1979, the Fed could have just kept all the interest rates across the yield curve at 2% and nothing bad would have happened. No, the reason, you know, Volcker felt the need to, quote, jack up interest rates was because price inflation was getting out of hand. And so, yeah, there's different levers you can adjust and whatnot, but ultimately it's not that the Fed can just cause planet Earth to do whatever the Fed wants. There's limits on its power. So yeah, I don't know. Did you want to say something on that?
Yeah. I'll just say that there is this sort of broad, as you say, there's this neglect among MMTers about the demand for debt, investors' willingness to purchase government debt. And it seems like whenever you push them on this, they always back into, they interpret it, or they maneuver that claim towards their claim that the government will always be able to repay its debts. So like, since it's an issuer, it'll always be able to repay. And almost as if like that's just like a quick, so like snap your finger sort of response to, well, what if people are less willing to purchase government debt for a variety of reasons? And they always try to back that into the government will always be able to repay its debts. But of course, then you can follow up, well, what about inflation expectations? What about the fact that investors may not want to purchase the debt at that extremely low interest rate because they're expecting, you know, deficits to increase and monetary inflation to increase? And so therefore, like, that's just not an attractive offer for them. And of course, we've seen examples even in recent times of countries losing control of the demand for their own debt. And so like we've had sovereign debt crises in the past, you know, 10, 15 years, especially over in Europe.
Yeah. And maybe this is a good time for me to circle back. So again, the fundamental, or not fundamental, but a major starting point for the MMT analysis is to say, hey, there is a huge difference, a qualitative difference between analyzing financial decision-making by households, major corporations, even governments, if those governments do not have the freedom to issue their own currency and borrow in debt denominated in their own currency. So it's what they call a sovereign currency issuer. All right. And so to be clear, the MMT analysis, where they're sort of exalting a few entities on this privileged plateau above everybody else, and they're saying, this is what we're talking about. It's not all governments around the world. So, you know, when people say, oh, what about Zimbabwe? They would just say, well, no, that's not what we're talking about. The Zimbabwe government was not able to finance all of its operations, you know, by issuing bonds denominated in its own currency. So it was not a sovereign currency issuer in that sense, or a sovereign monetary authority, maybe is the term they sometimes use. Whereas, so what's special about the U.S., Japan, and the U.K., the three she listed in that 2020 debate, is that the U.S. government not only issues dollars, because, you know, that's not particularly special. Governments around the world issue their own currency, but that, again, the U.S. has deep liquid bond markets around the world denominated in U.S. dollars. And so if the government, U.S. government, wants to run a deficit, it can just issue bonds like that, no problem. And then there's not going to be any issues. So why is that relevant? Because there's no danger of default risk. The U.S. government is always going to be able to honor the outstanding treasury debt. because it's denominated in the thing that it can create at will. Whereas, you know, some South American government that maybe has a sordid history of debt problems, international investors might be willing to lend that new regime money, but only if it's quoted in some more stable currency, because they don't trust that, banana republic and the institutions, they might just try to monetize their debt and just run the printing press. And so the investors want to protect themselves. They'll say, oh yeah, we'll lend to you, but only if it's denominated in euros or yen or dollars or British pounds. And so that's why that kind of a regime, if they get into trouble, their debt starts piling up as a share of GDP and whatever, they can get into a debt doom loop. Even Kelton would agree, because, oh, if they try to run their printing press, then that just makes their currency fall vis-a-vis the currency that their external debt's denominated in. But her point was that can't happen if the government is able to borrow in its own currency. That even if by running the printing press, it drives the value of its currency down vis-a-vis other currencies, so what? If the U.S. government owes people $35 trillion, it can just create $35 trillion. And even if doing that makes the dollar plummet against the yen and the euro, so what? They're not going to violate their contractual obligations. Yep, here's $35 trillion, just like we said. So that's where they're coming from. What's that?
Yeah, go buy a Snickers bar with that.
Right. So, I mean, yeah. That's, again, folks, I hope this is clicking. Whether we convince you or not, I want to get across our perspective on this and why we think this is a big non sequitur, that they're kind of just moving the action to a different spot. And so they're saying, oh, no, there's no danger. You know, we're not constrained fiscally. It's just if we print a bunch of money, then, yeah, maybe, as Jonathan says, prices escalate. But there's not any. But to me, that's not really giving us new options at our disposal that we knew all along that was a fallback option. And again, why do the investors around the world, just to finish that train of thought, why do they only trust a few governments right now and exalt them with this privileged monetary sovereign status to which, you know, the full beauty of MMT allegedly applies and kicks in? It's because the other governments can't be trusted. And so that's the thing too here, that ironically, to the extent that a few governments right now could, at least in the short term, get away with behaving the way Kelton and Warren Mosler and so forth recommend they behave, they would lose that status. They would forfeit it, right? Because again, why isn't it that investors around the world would trust, Malay, he comes in and why did he need to dollarize? Why couldn't he have just borrowed a bunch of new debt in the Argentine peso and just run? Because people got spooked by that and he had to switch to something else that the government couldn't debase. And so my point again being that if the U.S. government continues to behave like this, at some point investors are going to start saying, yeah, we don't trust them anymore. They're clearly just turning to the Fed to monetize their debts. And so we don't want to get paid back 20 years from now in U.S. dollars. We want to get paid back in whatever, some currency linked to gold or whatever, but that's the way it works. So again, it's just this funny thing where it's precisely the governments right now that in the past have been the most responsible and that have acted as if they had, you know, a fuddy-duddy gold standard thinking, that's why they now have this position to be able to, as the MMTers think, you know, break the conventional rules of finance.
Yeah, let me give a shout out to Joshua Mahorder. I think it's okay for me to say he's got a paper where he's working on this on that exact topic, where countries like the UK, Japan, and especially the US, they're held up as these like perfect examples of the monetary sovereigns for the MMT case. And he's showing that the way that they are able to achieve that so-called privileged status was by being responsible, having sound money, relatively free markets, lots of good sustainable economic growth for decades, if not centuries. And that's what drove all of the confidence in the debts of those governments, to the point where now they can do those sorts of MMT policies. And just as you said, Joshua Mahorder's argument is that, and this is an unpublished paper, I really hope it's okay for me to say this, but he's basically make the claim that you just said, that all of these MMT policy prescriptions will work to undo that sort of thing. So MMTers are sort of like latching onto these successful countries that have attained this sort of status, but then all of the recommendations that they have would actually remove that remove the ability that these countries have to do the sorts of things that they prescribe.
Exactly. So why don't we move on here now, folks, to give the other side of this, and then we'll kind of look at, you know, what was history kind to one or the other. And so this guy's name is Edward Chancellor. And who is he? They're saying the writer is a financial historian and author of a forthcoming history of interest. So that's, I should check that out since I got a dissertation on interest. But anyway, so again, this is back in May of 2020. So he's given the counterpoint to what we just quoted from Stephanie Kelton. And I'll just read a couple of things here. He says, the lockdown is a propitious moment to implement MMT. During crises, the public has an abnormally high demand to hold cash. Debt monetization appears less of a problem. But governments can print money to cover their costs for only as long as the public retains confidence in a currency. When the crisis passes, the excess money must be mopped up. And then he ends by saying, modern monetary practices ensure another inflation is around the corner. MMT provides the intellectual gloss. It promises a free lunch. Even Alice shouldn't believe that, because earlier he'd alluded to Alice in Wonderland. So how do you feel about that, Jonathan, before we go to the tape?
Well, it seems like he was right. It seems like there was a price inflation around the corner. And so it seems like he was pretty much on point. And that, Kelton and the MMT are saying that we don't need to worry about inflation, or at least if we do have inflation, then there are ways that we can address it. It seems like they caught the tail end of it. It seems like they were on the wrong end of that debate.
Yep. So I think, as we've seen, folks, here, a lot of it comes down to, the MMTers saying, come on, guys, we all know about inflation. We're not saying it's a free lunch. This is just such a straw man. But the point is, in practice, what we're claiming, the critics of this approach of MMTers, is to say, you're leading the public to believe you've just found this golden goose. Well, it's not a golden goose. A golden goose, that's old school. The fiat goose laying eggs that yet are real resource that you can actually eat, put it that way. They're not fiat eggs. As if we have this new margin to finance public expenditures. Like, we can have a Green New Deal. We can build a Mars station, a colony. We can have a jobs guarantee. All this stuff, our crumbling infrastructure. And, oh, my goodness, the bridges are collapsing. And the MMTers will always come and say, this is crazy. We got, people sitting at home unemployed. Just run the printing presses. This is nuts. We don't need you. We're not a company. We're not a household. Stop thinking that way, guys. All we got to do is print money. What's wrong with you? And yes, if price inflation ever should start to poke its head up, then we'll deal with that at that point. But, and I'm saying, or what the critics are saying, what that guy Chancellor was saying back in 2020 is, no, if we go down this path, particularly at a time as of May of 2020, when the public is panicked and they're hoarding cash, so printing up a bunch of new money won't immediately cause gasoline to jump up to $30 a gallon because nobody could drive, among other things, that's going to sow the seeds of inflation down the road that then is going to take painful measures to mop up. And so that clearly happened, as Jonathan said. And now the question is just, okay, well, did the MMTers see that? And so here, I think it's relevant and entirely fair to play this clip. So I dug this up. I Googled, folks, Stephanie Kelton, Team Transitory, and I found this clip from July 16th, 2021. All right, so Kelton was on Bloomberg, and we'll play the clip. Is only going to be like a minute or so long, just to pace yourself. So here's Kelton, and now to set the context for this, as of this point, July 2021, in the United States, as of the BLS's inflation report that came out that month. So I don't know. I probably had just dropped, and that was the reason for this hit, because clearly, as you'll hear in a minute, they're talking about the latest inflation data and that sort of thing. So as of that point, the year-over-year CPI increase, it had been steadily trending up, was about 5.3%. All right. And so that was very high, for historical standards for most Americans at that point. And what's going to happen is it's going to keep going up from this point forward up through June 2022, where it peaked at about 9%. Okay, so again, inflation right now, when these two are talking, is about 5.3, and it's going to keep rising for another 11 months and not stop until it peaks. And when I say that, I mean like the looking backward 12-month increase, that's going to peak at about 9% before it finally breaks and starts coming back down. So go ahead, we'll listen to this clip, and you folks tell me if it sounds like Kelton is fully aware that, yeah, it's possible, even though inflation right now is about 5.3%, it might get as high as 9% for another 11 months before it turns a corner and starts coming down. Let's see if it sounds like that's what she's warning people could be in store. And this was totally, you know, in her playbook and what she led people to believe.
All the debate out there right now in markets, in Washington, and everywhere in between right now is about inflation. Is it long lasting or is it transitory? When you look at the latest data that we have out there right now, and maybe some of the data that isn't making it to the large headline numbers here, what type of inflationary pressures are you seeing, and do you see them as being a little bit more permanent?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when I look at the data, what I think mostly this looks like are the growing pains of an economy that's emerging from a pandemic and reopening. And we see a lot of idiosyncratic pressures and supply chain issues and backlogs and that sort of stuff. So I think by and large, what it looks like to me is the kind of thing that, frankly, we anticipated, right, coming out of the pandemic. And so it's pretty hard for me to see the kinds of things that I think you would need to be in place in order to get the sort of entrenched inflation that begins to feed on itself. So I guess I situate myself pretty squarely in the transitory camp.
Okay, so there you have it, folks. My take, my reaction to that is no, she had absolutely no idea. Well, we don't know what she actually knew was coming, but she led the public to believe, yeah, this is just supply bottle. And she's also claiming, oh yeah, we've been warning all along. In the May 2020 exchange we just went through, I didn't see her saying anything about, now don't get me wrong, there's major supply bottlenecks, and so we might see the highest inflation in 30 years, but don't worry. She didn't say anything like that. So she was saying, no, what are we talking about? Governments can set the price of bonds. They don't even need to borrow. This is just a gift to the bondholders. Why would anyone be? That's what she was saying there. But now here, when inflation has risen to more than double what the Fed's preferred target is, she's saying, oh, yeah, we told you this would happen. But don't worry. It's just, you know, transitory supply shocks, bottlenecks from the pandemic. And I didn't get the sense from that she was going to say, oh, yeah, inflation's probably going to get as high as it's been since the early 80s. I that wasn't jumping out at me. Jonathan, what was your take?
Oh, the same. Yeah. So it seems to me that they totally missed. And there was sort of like this quiet period during like the late 2021 to late 2022, where like the MMTers were not really talking about the whole inflation issue very much. And a lot of people were writing about, they were sort of like writing an obituary for MMT at that point, because it seemed like the price inflation that we were seeing was a clear refutation of MMT. But of course they've come back. So, and not necessarily because inflation has come down to the Fed's target, because like even recently, inflation seems to be, it hasn't gone below 3%. Has it? Yeah. I don't think it has. It's sort of hovering above 3, even now. And even in the past few months, it's ticked up. So, I think you're exactly right. Kelton missed the inflation, and to the point where a lot of people were actually saying that MMT ideas are dead. It seems like they're sort of, you know, hiding in their holes during this whole inflationary period. So
now let me get the elephant in the room. I was wrong about, I thought there would be high CPI inflation after QE.
Bob, yes. You got to stop.
No, I'm going to do it.
Okay. You do this like every single interview. No. I mean, it's fine. That's fine. It's very honest for you to do.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to put that out there. Right. Okay. So now on this one, the, what's interesting is the gaslighting, because it's worse even than you may have just led the listeners to believe, Jonathan, that not. So yeah, right when they said, oh, come on, team transitory, and Krugman even had a thing around this period talking about how inflation peaked, and he was mocking the inflation scare, you know, making fun of Fox News and, you know, the right wingers and the Ron Paul types. Where, and again, it was so bad, folks, that Krugman even had to come out and say he was wrong about inflation, which is a very rare thing when Krugman just literally admits. But then you're right. They just waited a little bit and then came back and said, yeah, we were right all along. And I'm not putting words in their mouth. That's what they said. So Krugman has, since admitting he was wrong, has now come back and said, yeah, basically Team Transitory was right. Okay. And so here's what happened. The people like Krugman were saying, don't jack up interest rates. That is unnecessary. You're going to cause the economy to go into a recession for no reason. This is transitory. It's supply bottlenecks. The Fed didn't listen. They jacked up rates quite aggressively. And meaning like how rapidly they went from basically zero to whatever is now 5.3%. The how quickly they did that was way more than a lot of people recommended. And then inflation came down. And by inflation, I mean year-over-year consumer price inflation. And so, you know, Krugman's run around victory laps saying, see, we told you, inflation came down on its own, no rate hikes necessary, which how would you know that? You know, looking, okay, fine. And now Kelton, I don't know if you know this, Jonathan, what she's doing is going around saying, yeah, MMT called it. The reason CPI inflation is stubbornly remaining, you know, at a 3% and not falling even further, despite the Fed rate hikes, is because as MMT has been saying all along, higher interest rates cause inflation to go higher. And she actually had a quote saying the data have been kind to the theory or the thesis that higher interest rates will lead to may lead to higher inflation, something like that. So I'll put a link, folks, so you can see the exact words. So again, it's just the gaslighting is incredible that inflation started out low. The government pumps in a bunch of money. People were saying, uh-oh, that's going to cause inflation. Kelton said, no, it won't. Inflation starts picking up. And Kelton said, we've seen the worst of it. This is just transitory. Inflation basically went to double where it was when she said that. Then finally it breaks. The Fed starts jacking up rates and, you know, tightening. M2 actually shrank for a while. And, you know, the Fed's balance sheet has been shrinking for a while and continues to. So it's not just the interest rates, but other measures of monetary policy have been tightening against the advice, certainly of Krugman. I don't know if Kelton was saying whether they should tighten or not. I'm assuming not, but I don't have that as a, you know, in stone here. Inflation came down and now Kelton's running around doing victory laps saying, see, we told you the Fed raising rates will lead to higher inflation. It's astonishing. Okay. So I'll stop. Jonathan, do you have any final remarks on this before we got to wrap up?
No, I think we've covered it all. Just one last thing, since this is for the Mises Institute, all about Austrian economics. Whenever we're talking about government debt and the demand for government bonds, a lot of people will get sort of tied up in like these debt crises and the problems associated with the debt, which I think there are some problems, but it's worth reminding good students of Austrian economics that according to Mises and Rothbard, really the central problem is the level of government spending and also the redistributive effects of money printing, and that the debt is sort of like this byproduct of too much or really a lot of government spending, but really it's the spending where all of the resources are wasted. So we should, to the extent that we have control over where the narrative goes and the online debates go, it seems like we should really try to stick with the idea that the waste happens when the government initially spends.
Yeah.
And then there are all these other unintended consequences that come with how the government finances that spending, whether it's through direct taxation, whether it's through debt monetization or selling bonds. The central issue where the waste happens is with the spending.
Yes,
just want to make sure I got that in this episode.
Yeah, thank you. Very, very good point. And again, folks, just to underscore what he's saying, it's certainly not, don't take the message that, oh, so therefore, if the government needs to spend a bunch of money, it should raise taxes to not borrow. That clearly is not what we're saying. It's, yes, government's redirecting resources into political channels rather than what the private voluntary market sector would do with those resources. That's the fundamental problem. But on top of that, like you see accounting manifestations of things like that in terms of it seems painless on the front end if the government just borrows money. And yet, as we've been pointing out, no, that does lead to problems down the road. It's not just because it's a monetary sovereign that all those things magically disappear. Okay, well, we got to wrap up there. Thank you, Jonathan, for helping me dissect this debate.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thank you, folks, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Check back next week for a new episode of the Human Action Podcast. In the meantime, you can find more content like this on Mises.org.